for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. New technology is driving major advances in medicine. Patients with diseased or deformed body parts are finding new hope in custom-made skin and bladders. And 3D printers are being used to make artificial ears that look and function just like real ones. Joining me to talk about emerging medical technologies and their ethical implications, Deborah Matthews of Johns Hopkins University, and from the NPR Bureau in New York City, Dr. Jason Spector of Weill Cornell Medical College, joining us from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Dr. Anthony Atala of Wake Forest University Baptist Medical Center. I do invite you to be part of the program. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And welcome to all of you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Same here, Diane.
Yes, thank you, Diane.
Dr. Atala, I'll start with you. This sounds like pretty exciting stuff. Talk about 3D medical printing and how it has become so revolutionary.
You know, it's really interesting. You know, 3D printing has been around now for quite a while in terms of other industries like the automotive industry and creating devices, but now it has really moved into much more sophisticated areas in medicine. For example, printing devices which are specifically made for the patient. So instead of actually having a device that you implant into the patient and just take one out of a box and try to make it fit into a patient, like a device that goes in a piece of bone or cartilage, you can now basically take an x-ray of the patient, three-dimensionally configure what that shape looks like, and put it right back into the patient after it gets printed. And even more advanced is the technology of actually printing tissues and organs using the patient's own cells.
So tell us how it works, Dr. Atala. How do you create these new organs or bones or what have you? How does the 3D printer work?
You know, it's really interesting. The first thing, of course, is trying to figure out how to make these tissues grow and how to make sure you make them in a normal manner. And basically, the field was started by creating tissues and organs using the patient's own cells, where you take a very small piece of tissue, less than half the size of a postage stamp, of the tissue of interest from the same patient. You then expand those cells outside the body from that piece of tissue. You grow the cells in an incubator, create a three-dimensional mold, if you will, using artificial materials that are degradable over time, very much like using the same materials that we use for sutures during surgery that dissolve on their own. We then place those cells on these structures, allow them to mature, and then we implant them back into the patient. And that's a traditional way of doing these things, where we have been doing that now for a number of years. And the printer is really a way to just scale it up. You have to know how to make these tissues in that manner before you start scaling it up to a 3D printer, where in reality, what you're really doing is printing one layer at a time of the tissue, the cells. You're basically, instead of placing the cells in a three-dimensional mold, you place the cells in this cartridge, and instead of using ink, you're using cells. And you're printing this one layer at a time until you end up with this three-dimensional structure.
Dr. Anthony Atala, he's director of the Institute for Regenerative Medicine at Wake Forest University Baptist Medical Center. Turning to you, Dr. Jason Spector, how long does this whole process take?
Well, it really depends upon what you are trying to make. If you're making implants which are not, in fact, biologic, but are made out of, let's say, a form of plastic, then the process, starting with acquisition of the data, meaning, as Dr. Atala said, getting an appropriate X-ray or CAT scan from which the three-dimensional defect can be determined, it's a matter of literally hours to days to transmit that data and have that printed or built up out of usually, at this point, most of the time, some plastic resins are used or sometimes even metals can be printed. And that can be delivered back to you as the surgeon, sterilized and ready for implantation literally within a matter of days to weeks. If you're talking about biologics, that is a much more varied answer, again, depending upon what you're trying to create and the size and scale of what you're trying to create. That's something that really is more in the future. The now is printing up materials, like I said, that are non-biologic but are still very crucial for what we're doing surgically.
So you seem to be saying that while you can, by use of 3D, create knee replacements or something like that, you're dealing with a blood supply if you're trying to create an organ like a kidney or a liver.
Well, that's just it. And the blood supply is really the crucial limiting factor in tissue engineering in general. When we talk about things that have been accomplished in tissue engineering, most of the tissues, for example, cartilage, is a very unique tissue in the body because it does not require a direct blood supply. There are no blood vessels within cartilage. So a tissue like cartilage, I would say, is sort of the low-hanging fruit of tissue engineering and bioprinting because you don't have to worry about how are you going to get blood vessels into that material. And designing blood vessels on a scale, as you can imagine, of capillaries and very small vessels, which are fractions of a millimeter in size, that is currently beyond our technological capabilities, and that's something that's definitely an active focus of research in mine and a lot of other labs across the country and across the world.
But what about the ability to create, for example, an ear? Why can that happen? I gather there's a difference here.
Right. So, again, the ear, which is made out of a very special type of cartilage called auricular or elastic cartilage, is made of that material which does not require a blood supply.
I see.
So, for example, the traditional way that surgeons would reconstruct the ear would be to use cartilage harvested from a child's ribs. The downside of that is it's not only painful, obviously, to take several pieces of ribs from a young child, and this might be done as young as 6 years of age or up to 12 years of age. But additionally, that cartilage that is taken from the rib, that's not bendable, pliable cartilage like your ear. So anything that you can construct out of that cartilage is naturally going to be much more stiff, like rib cartilage, and that's going to affect how it looks. And perhaps even most importantly, except in the most skilled hands, carving a new ear, an appropriately accurate rendition of an ear out of rib cartilage, is excruciatingly difficult. So that's where bioprinting lends itself to significantly increasing the accuracy of the reconstruction. So we can take a three-dimensional picture of a child's ear, and in most cases, a child with a condition called microtia, where they're born without an ear or with a significantly deformed ear, is usually on one side. So they have a normal ear on the other side. You can take a three-dimensional picture of their normal ear. You can turn that into digital data. And from that data, you can print up an exact replica of the normal ear. So again, using materials that are very common in the human body, we have, with my collaborator Larry Benasser up in Cornell and Ithaca, we have demonstrated that we can make not only highly accurate examples of ears, but ones that are biologically active. That is, we take cells, cartilage cells, and put them in a matrix of collagen, which you can think of as basically jello, And after even as early as 3 months, those cells will remake the material around them, the jello, into actual elastic cartilage. And so after 3 years, what we take out, and so far these have not been done in humans yet, but the ears that are taken out will look like ears, they will bend like ears, and for all intents and purposes, they are ears. And because it's cartilage, because it doesn't require a direct blood supply, you can transplant these large pieces of tissue, and when I say large, I mean a couple centimeters, and they will survive. So we're very excited about that.
I'm sure you are, but Dr. Spector, if you're talking about creating an ear for an infant, as that infant grows, I would think you'd have to replace that ear with a different size.
Well, that is a consideration, and just like in the standard approach, the age at which you perform the reconstruction is very much surgeon-dependent, although I would say most people will do it at about the age of 8 to 10 years for that exact reason.
Dr. Jason Spector, he's director of the Laboratory for Bioregenerative Medicine and Surgery. He's at Weill Cornell Medical College. Short break here. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the concerns about this new technology.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. From Cancer Treatment Centers of America, where nutritional therapy is an integral part of every patient's treatment plan. More at cancercenter.com. And from American Jewish World Service, working in developing countries to end poverty and advance human rights. Information available at ajws.org.
We're talking in this hour about new technology driving major advances in medicine. We're talking about creating new or deformed body parts, creating new hope for people in custom-made skin, ears, bladders, limbs, really an incredible new world of medicine. Here in the studio, Deborah Matthews. She's at the Johns Hopkins University Berman Institute of Bioethics, joining us from NPR in New York City. Dr. Jason Spector, he's at the Weill Cornell Medical College in New York City. And by phone from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Dr. Anthony Atala. He's at the Wake Forest University Baptist Medical Center. Well, Dr. Matthews, you've heard all that has been said so far. It sounds like exciting new technology, but I gather you have some reservations, some concerns.
Yes, thank you. I, like you, think that this technology is amazing, and the capacity that it has to help individuals with certain conditions is fantastic. As a method of manufacture, I honestly don't see a problem with it. I mean, if we can make better fit parts more quickly, as long as it's safe and we're using materials that we have a track record of safety in humans, et cetera, great. I mean, you have the standard questions of the introduction of a new technology into medicine with safety. What are the risks and benefits? Who is going to have access to the technology
because of cost?
Mm-hmm. I think it gets particularly interesting when you combine 3D printing with another new biomedical technology that is stem cell research, which was also mentioned earlier in the show. Because stem cell research comes with its own sort of set of ethical concerns and discussions that need to happen, not only with regard to safety, but also the ethical issues. Some people have very serious concerns about the ethics of embryonic stem cell research, for example. This isn't the only kind of stem cell that we have, of course. We've been doing adult stem cell transplants for decades in the form of bone marrow transplants, et cetera. Embryonic stem cells, of course, you need to destroy a human embryo to get embryonic stem cells. This is a very, very early human cell. It's about 5 days old, It's about 5 days old, has about 200 to 300 cells. And you have to take that apart and take out the inner cell mass and culture that in a dish to get embryonic stem cells. And that part of the process is deeply problematic to some people. And it has resulted in tremendous debate, not only here in the U.S., but internationally, having to do with the ethics of that and whether or not we ought fund the research. Here in the U.S., we've made the decision that we will fund the research. And in Maryland, where I'm from, the state itself has determined that it will fund the research because we've determined that the benefits of the science, the potential benefits of the science, have, from a policy perspective, outweighed the concerns that some people have about the science.
Dr. Atalay, how do you speak to those concerns?
Yeah, I think those are very valid concerns. And I think, you know, a lot of these technologies today really are being focused on the patient's own cells. So the technology is really based on going to the patient with the injured organ, taking a small piece of tissue from the normal part of that organ, growing those cells out, and using those cells to print right back into the patient. So because you're using the patient's own cells, you do away with a lot of the ethical issues that are involved with other stem cell types. But of course, the first-in-human challenges are always there. Anytime you're bringing these new technologies to patients, you have to make sure that the patients and their families understand that even though there has been a lot of testing done with these technologies, they're really walking partially into the unknown as they are the first ones to experience that technology.
I gather, Dr. Atala, years ago you constructed a bladder in your laboratory that was implanted into a college student. First of all, how is that person doing? And second, were stem cells used in the creation of that bladder?
Yes, that patient is still doing very well. We did a series. Yes, we are very glad to. He's doing very well. We did a series of patients that we published on. Those patients that we published on with that refined technology continue to do well many years later, basically about 13 years later now. And we are still expanding that technology and also going into other tissues that we have also engineered and also implanted into patients. So we are trying to expand the number of tissues that we put into patients and expand the number of patients that get treated with these technologies.
Well, I gather there is this huge need for human organs, especially kidneys, livers. To what extent do you believe 3D printing can address that need?
I think it can really help out in this technology in a major way. And basically the reason for that is that, you know, we had talked earlier about how we used to make these by hand, one at a time. So when we were creating these tissues for patients, we were basically laying the cells one layer at a time, very much like baking a layer cake, if you will. You're basically taking the scaffold and laying those cells one layer at a time until you have your construct the way you want it, and then you would put that in an oven-like device that had the same conditions as a human body. You would let the tissue mature. We would put that back into the patient. But with that strategy, again, you're creating these organs one at a time, and that's okay when we're doing small clinical trials with small numbers of patients. But when you're talking about doing this in thousands of patients at the same time, you really do need to automate the process. And the bioprinter really acts as a scale-up tool. It really acts to make sure that you can really create many of these at the same time. And in addition, it also gives you two added benefits, one being more precision, because you know exactly where you're laying those cells as you're printing these structures. Mm. And the third benefit is basically reproducibility. So you can make sure that the same type of structure will be printed each time. So the bioprinter technology really gives you three things: scalability, reproducibility, and precision.
And to you, Dr. Spector, most of us think of ink in printers as being ordinary ink. Now, how does the ink in these 3D medical printers differ from what we normally see?
Well, just like you can think of ink in a regular printer as a solvent containing a pigment, the bioink is basically any material which will carry the cells. So you can think of the cells as the pigment. And so bioink can be a very wide-ranging variety of materials, ranging from collagen. As I talked about, collagen is the most common protein found in the body. You can make bioink out of hyaluronic acid, another commonly found protein in the body. You can make it out of materials that are compatible with cells but aren't necessarily found naturally in the human body. But most importantly, it has to be non-toxic to the cells. It hopefully could facilitate cell growth. And the nice thing is you can add or dope the materials with, let's say, growth factors and other proteins that will not only sustain the cell's health, but in fact push them to maybe divide more and turn into different types of cells that would be beneficial for whatever you're trying to build.
But tell us about your issues and the difficulties you've had to create body replacement tissue. How does it address the blood supply issue you talked about earlier?
Well, you know, to be honest, so far it hasn't. And that is why most biologic bioprinting that has been done has focused either on cartilage, so we have our ears. There are groups that are printing discs to replace degenerated spine discs. There are groups working on printing articular cartilage, that is cartilage within joints. So again, cartilage is a logical first alternative because there are no blood vessels.
Sure.
And talking about, let's say, bioprinting skin, skin again is obviously a very commonly transplanted organ that we do as reconstructive surgeons all the time in the form of a skin graft. What's unique about a skin graft? Well, it's really thin. So you can actually transplant it without a blood supply, and within 2 or 3 days, the body will grow into it and deliver a blood supply. Once you get beyond, when you're talking about skin grafts, you're talking about something that's on the order of about 1/100 of an inch thick. Once you get much thicker than that, you have problems with the cells staying alive long enough for the blood vessels to grow into them. So that's why it's a major challenge. And before, I am a reconstructive microsurgeon, so that means I move large pieces of tissue around the body. The only reason those larger pieces of tissue survive, just like an organ transplantation, is because you're immediately reconnecting the blood supply. So if you can reconnect the blood supply to a piece of tissue within a few hours, the cells within it will survive. anything more than, you know, 4 to 24 hours, depending upon what type of cell you're talking about, they're going to die. So that's the challenge. And like I said before, our printing technology has yet to get to a point where we can print up the negative spaces. You can imagine, you know, printing up hollow channels, really tiny hollow channels within whatever you're trying to build. Most of the bio-inks we use are sort of gelatinous. That is, you know, they don't harden right away. And so if you tried to print up a negative space, if you think about it, it would collapse on itself. There are technologies we're working on whereby we print up two different materials at the same time, one of which serves as a scaffold, if you can think about it that way, and then you can dissolve away that scaffold from within the surrounding bulk material, so that once the bulk material has hardened, you dissolve away the inner scaffold and you're left with these hollow channels.
Huh.
That's a first step. Then you have to line those hollow channels with cells, because if you just put blood through these hollow channels, it'll naturally clot, because that's what the blood wants to do.
So you have
to line these channels with special cells called endothelial cells, which line all of our blood vessels in our body and prevents the blood from spontaneously clotting. So lots of technical challenges,
sure,
but we're certainly making lots of progress.
Dr. Matthews, what kind of regulatory oversight is there for this new technique of 3D bioprinting and these other new approaches?
Mm-hmm. Well, we haven't, because these technologies are new, we don't have really well worked out models all the time for figuring out how to regulate them. I think in the case of many of the sort of one individual patient interventions, it's sort of medical innovation, right? You're designing a piece for this particular person based on their ear or their trachea, which is hard to regulate at a sort of very high level, right? You're talking about a very individualized treatment or intervention. And in a lot of ways, we're still trying to figure it out. FDA, of course, regulates drugs and devices, and there are ways that we do that. FDA approves clinical trials for these new interventions. For stem cell research, for example, there have only been a small handful of clinical trials approved. And the first one, the trial that was run by Geron for spinal cord injury, was, I think, the largest FDA filing ever. They required so much paperwork and information and data because it was new. And I think it was Dr. Spector who made the point about first-in-human trials. There will always be unknowns in first-in-human trials. There will always be unknown risks. And we have to be very clear with patients when they are the first one or one of the first handful of folks.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Dr. Matthews, you talked earlier about concerns regarding costs. So are you saying that most of these advanced techniques would, at least for now, be available only to those who can afford to pay a great deal?
Yes, frequently when a new technology comes on the market in the medical field or otherwise, it's available to well-off people first, right? It's, as Dr. Atala was explaining earlier, those early bladders, they had to build by hand. That's an incredibly intensive, specialist-driven, high level of information, skill, experience required for each one of those interventions. And I think that, you know, one of the promises of 3D printing is the ability to scale up. As we scale up, things become less expensive, but access is a very real issue.
And tell us about the so-called do-it-yourself labs. How many of those are there in the U.S.? What kind of work is going on there?
Mm-hmm. So there have developed over the last decade or so a a whole bunch of do-it-yourself labs. So DIY labs in various places across the world, across the country. There are a couple of dozen here in the U.S. There's one in my hometown of Baltimore. And these are, it's sort of the democratization of science.
But what can they do?
Lots of people are doing very basic things like making their own yogurt, right? Using, doing their own fermentations, et cetera. But it's a whole range of things. There was at the lab in Baltimore, there was a zebrafish project. So it was genetics and zebrafish and looking at various questions there. They have lots of these places have 3D printers and are experimenting with what can they do in the labs. I mean, some of these labs are incredibly well outfitted, have, you know, pretty much everything but a DNA sequencer.
Well, just for your information, I can make yogurt at home without a 3D printer.
Absolutely.
And we're going to take a short break here. When we come back, we'll open the phones, read your email, and talk more about 3D printing in the medical realm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Cy Sims Foundation. Since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a better life. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
On the next Fresh Air, in honor of the final edition of the Colbert Report, we pay tribute to Stephen Colbert and listen back to excerpts of our interviews with him, including one recorded just a few weeks after the Colbert Report premiered. Join us.
And welcome back. As you can imagine, we have many questions and callers. Here is a tweet from Wendy, who says, what are the implications of this 3D printing for Mohs surgery for those with skin cancer? Dr. Atala.
Well, I think that's actually a great question, because now we're trying to develop some printing technologies where you not only just print, but you can actually scan the wound. And this is designed for patients with skin defects or larger tissue defects on the surface. So the concept here is that you would have a scanner that scans the wound on the surface of the patient. Then that information would be digitally transferred to the printer, and the printer right there and then would print on the patient's surface one layer at a time, until the whole construct was completed. And that's actually a technology that's being developed. So that may be useful someday for patients with Mohs surgery. Mohs surgery is a technology where if you have skin cancer, they have to keep taking a slice of skin over and over again till they find the full depth of the cancer in the skin. And sometimes that can leave a bad scar. So this may be a way to actually repair it in the future.
Dr. Spector, how close are you to that?
Well, it's funny because I just operated on a Mohs defect this morning before I came here. And, you know, this is a good example of where the technology itself, as fantastic as it is, may not be quite ready to replace what we do surgically. And that's not because what we do surgically is you know, our skill is so great, but printing skin, if you're talking about printing skin as just a cover, and the skin's most important vital function is to serve as a cover so that we don't all dry up and desiccate and lose all our fluid, but to print up skin that actually looks like the native tissue, I think, is far, far away. And that's because you have to get the color match right. You have to get the texture right. You have to get the hair-bearing cells in there. You have to get the sweat glands and other things that make skin look like skin. And until we have that level of complexity, I don't think we're going to be printing up skin so quickly. And an old adage in reconstructive surgery is you want to, the best reconstruction is you replace like tissue with like tissue. Well, most often the best replacement is in the area adjacent to where the defect is.
I
so I think we're a little further away from printing up skin for those types of situations.
All right, let's open the phones. We'll go now to Peter in Carmel, Indiana. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Diane. It's an honor to speak to you and your panel. Every Monday through Friday listener, and holiday greetings from the great state of Indiana. Hope you attend the Indy 500 sometime. It's a real lot of fun.
Good.
My question is, I guess, pretty vanity-filled. For 45 years, I've suffered, so to speak, with male pattern baldness. And I know it's a vanity, like I said, in vain, but it is a challenge psychologically. Any breaking news forefront with your panel for both male pattern baldness, and I know women can suffer from that too, of course. And
sure. All right. Thanks for calling. And to you, Dr. Atala.
Yeah, there's actually some interesting work being done right now. Of course, you know, a lot of the work we're describing is work in the research arena, but there is very interesting work now being done for patients with baldness where there are technologies which are in clinical trials to for hair regrowth using the patient's own stem cells. And there's also some work that's being done with medications in that area as well. So, in fact, you can right now have hair transplants, for example, which is commonly available today. But other technologies which are being developed include stem cells from the same patient for hair regrowth, as well as newer medications that are coming online.
And we have a tweet from John. How long until you can make a fully functional kidney that can be implanted and not rejected? First to you, Dr. Atala.
Well, we have been working on kidneys for a number of years. The kidney is a three-dimensional organ. It's a solid organ, so it's much more complex. Basically, the level of complexities are flat structures such as skin, which are the least complex, cartilage and skin. Not very complex. They are complex, but not as complex as tubular structures such as blood vessels, which have two major cell types, more complex in its anatomy and architecture. Hollow non-tubular organs being the third level of complexity, like the bladder or the stomach. And finally, the most complex organs being the solid organs, like the kidney or the heart or the lung. Many strategies for solid organs. In the kidney, we're able to create miniature structures that are about the size of a lemon that have been implanted experimentally only, and they have they're shown that they can, in fact, have the functionality of a miniature kidney, and they secrete urine like a miniature kidney. The challenge is how to make those larger over time so that we can someday implant those in patients, but that's still a while from here.
Dr. Spector, how do you see it?
Yeah, I think because of all the technological challenges that have been discussed so far, I would say we're at least a decade away from implanting engineered organs, whether they are manufactured via bioprinting, whether they're manufactured via other technologies. A common approach that other tissue engineers use these days is to take the organ, start with the organ, take all the cells out through as gentle a process as possible, and then you have basically the matrix. You have the organ without any cells, so you can repopulate that organ with the patient's own cells, and therefore you can transplant that theoretically into the patient, and you would not have any issues with rejection, no matter, you know, where it originally came from. Again, the problem with this approach is it's very complicated and it's extremely difficult to line all of the blood vessels within the tissue with these specialized endothelial cells that will prevent thrombosis or clotting of the blood once you implant it. So until these technological hurdles are overcome, I think it's still going to be a ways away. But in terms of getting into the clinical realm, the cartilage-based tissues, I think that's a lot closer. Certainly within the next couple years, we'll start seeing that.
Dr. Adala, what about the role of intellectual property in advancing these medical technologies? How many patents do you own, and why are they so important?
Well, you know, the intellectual property really is something that belongs to universities when we do the work. So, of course, I work at the Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine at Wake Forest University. And the work that we do belongs to the university. And the patents are really important because that is really what allows these technologies to be transferred to patients through development, because when the investment really needs to be made to transfer these technologies, it really has to be done where it can be in an industry-based strategy where these can really be distributed in large numbers. So up to this point, we've been able to implant engineered tissues which are flat in patients, tubular structures that we have also implanted in patients, engineered tissues, and also hollow non-tubular organs. We have not yet implanted a solid organ into a patient. That's still going to be a while,
sure,
like we mentioned. But any time we did some of these technologies, of course, there's intellectual property that the universities own, and then they use that intellectual property to actually make sure that the technology can be developed at an industrial level.
I see. All right. Let's take a caller here in Washington, D.C. Marilyn, you're on the air.
Okay, I have a very simple, well, it's a probably a complicated question, but it sounds simple. I'm going back to your discussion earlier in the program about these ears. I want to know, these ears that they're constructing, are they for cosmetic purposes, or can people actually hear with them?
Dr. Spector.
So the ears that we are in the process of manufacturing are the external ear, which developmentally is completely unrelated to the inner ear, or the portion that is connected to the brain that allows you to actually make sense out of the sounds. And so this, I guess you could say it's completely cosmetic, although the external ear is sort of a serves to focus the sound and allow people to hear things they might not otherwise be able to hear. Additionally, most patients born with microtia, which is the condition where you are missing a large portion of the ear, do not have an auditory canal, meaning they don't have the tube that leads to the middle ear. That also has to be constructed. But patients can hear. It's called conductive hearing. So I guess you could say it's cosmetic, but really, you know, you're talking about a child without an ear. It's certainly a significant reconstructive issue.
I should say. Thanks for your call, Marilyn. Let's go to Bruce. He's in Ann Arbor, Michigan. You're on the air. Bruce, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, sir. Go right ahead.
Yeah. It goes back to your last show. Was it last week on the macular degeneration? Remember that one?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I have a retinal disease and central serous retinopathy, which also affects my RPE layer, which gets damaged with other eye diseases. And it's just a single cell layer that's damaged. And there has been work on repairing that with stem cells. And actually, Dr. Yamanaka? Yeah, you know. Won the 2012 Nobel Prize for using not stem cells, embryonic, but cells from skin.
Induced pluripotent stem cells.
Right. So you bypass that sort of moral issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you had any groups working with the 3D in combination with printing cells for the retina.
All right, Dr. Atala.
Well, interestingly, there are a few clinical trials now ongoing. Well, one of them is actually by Dr. Yamanaka that you mentioned. There's also another trial going on here in the U.S. at several centers for retinal disease. Not specifically the one that you mentioned, though, that you have. Right now, it's for two other conditions also that affect the retina, where they're taking stem cells and using those stem cells to inject into the retinal space. And what they have found in the early studies here in the U.S. is that those cells are able to incorporate into the retina and are improving vision. Those similar trials are going to be done in Japan. They just started in Japan with Dr. Yamanaka. So we'll see what those results show as well. These are using different kinds of stem cells. Mm-hmm. But basically, that technology at this point is really not amenable to the printing technology because all you have to do is just inject these cells into the retinal space, and the cells are showing that they can, in fact, adhere and provide function.
Dr. Anthony Atala, he is at the Wake Forest University Baptist Medical Center, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Shree in Plano, Texas. Hi there.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a question that I have, probably looking out into our children's generation. And so first I want to congratulate all the inventors and the doctors who have been behind this kind of breakthrough. And if I step into my children or my children's grandchildren's life and look at it, if they can build organs, say kidneys, heart, liver, one day bladder, brain maybe, I'm wondering if we can now start replacing parts from our human body, just like we replace parts in our car. One day we can have all parts literally replaceable, and so we will conquer cell death, so to speak. And I'm wondering, is this the step towards immortality?
Dr. Matthews.
Well, the truth is we've been replacing parts for a while now, right? People get new hips. People get new
Kidneys. Get new knees. Heart.
Yes. So we have made, as society, a decision that at least some level of replacement, organ replacement, tissue replacement is acceptable, right? We do that. It's not particularly controversial. As we go forward and we're able to replace more and more parts, we'll have to have a societal conversation about the risks and benefits of that and the values associated with sort of endless replacement of parts if we get to a place technologically where we're able to do that. And that's a big if. But it's something that we'll have to have a conversation about, and we'll have to make policy decisions about.
Where do you see this field of biomedical engineering headed?
Well, right now it's very, very early, right? It's very early in 3D printing of replacement parts and certainly of organs. I mean, Dr. Atala and Spector have been, I think, very appropriately conservative in what they're willing to say about where we are now, right? We haven't, I mean, a kidney, for example, is going to be incredibly difficult to do, incredibly difficult to do. And it's hard for us to predict, you know, when the jump is going to happen that allows us to do that, the sort of intellectual innovation that allows us to figure out how to do that. Sometimes we think it will take quite a long time, and then all of a sudden, there it is. I mean, this happened with Yamanaka, who was mentioned earlier in iPS cells. We thought, you know, embryonic stem cells were around, human embryonic stem cells in 1998. As I mentioned before, for some people, they're controversial. One of the alternatives that was imagined was induced pluripotent stem cells. And we thought that that would be quite some time down the road. This is the idea that you can take an adult cell, like a cheek swab, and give it a sort of fountain of youth kind of treatment and take it back to a more immature state where it's pluripotent and can turn into any of the 220-odd cell types in the human body. And then in 2006, Yamanaka said he had done it. And it was astonishing to the field. It happened much more quickly than we thought it would.
So is the possibility there of taking a stem cell from a kidney and creating from it a new kidney?
Well, again, that it, as has been mentioned by the two other guests, that's an incredibly complicated endeavor because it's not just about the cell, it's about the structure and the scaffold and the blood supply and the function and all of that.
But it could be eventually. Thank you all so much. Deborah Matthews, she is at the Johns Hopkins University. Jason Spector, he's at Weill Cornell Medical College. Anthony Atala, he's at Wake Forest University Baptist Medical Center. Thank you all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.